Good afternoon, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you are in the know. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org, on Facebook and Twitter, and on our YouTube channel. I'm Josh Richmond, a political journalist for the Bay Area News Group, and your moderator for today's program. Our guest is the one and only Barney Frank. A Bayonne, New Jersey native, Congressman Frank graduated from Harvard before becoming active in the civil rights movement and later delayed his doctoral studies to take a job in Boston City Hall, a delay I believe extends to this day. Elected to the Massachusetts legislature in 1972, he earned his Harvard Law degree in 1977 and was elected to Congress in 1980. During his more than 30 years in the United States Congress, he was a brilliant and strategic lawmaker who brokered deals with those on both sides of the aisle. As chairman of the House Financial Services Committee, he tirelessly fought during his 10 years economic storm for sweeping reform of the financial services industry. He was a critical bridge between polarized opinions and the subprime mortgage foreclosure issue by concentrating on areas of agreement and working from there. But much of his life's work has been about fighting for civil rights, including the rights of women and members of the LGBT community. In 1987, Barney Frank became the first member of Congress to come out voluntarily as gay. And in 2012, he married his longtime partner, James Reddy, becoming the first sitting member of Congress to marry someone of the same gender. We are very grateful that he has come back to the Commonwealth Club after his retirement to talk about his lifetime of stories and his new political memoir called Frank, A Life in Politics, From the Great Society to Same-Sex Marriage. Please welcome back to San Francisco, Barney Frank.
Thank you. Thank you, Jeff.
So the book... You describe the book as a personal history of two seismic shifts in American life, the sharp drop in prejudice against LGBT people and the equally sharp increase in anti-government opinion. Tell me how you came to sort of marry these into this narrative of this book.
Well, it's the story of my life. I began when I was a teenager thinking about getting into politics and motivated by a desire to get society to shape up. I mean, I wanted to make things better. I had a set of liberal values. I hated the notion of poor children. I didn't like discrimination. Interestingly, when I was 14, 15, beginning this in the 50s, I was focused on racial discrimination, still a great problem in America, because the idea that we would be able to do anything for those of us who were gay or lesbian was too far-fetched. I mean, that was not even a moonshot. That was coming at Neptune from the other side. I said, I have this problem. I want to be active in politics so I can change society. I want to be influential in government. But I'm a homosexual, as we then called it, so I probably never will be. And I thought, well, I'll try. So I thought if I repressed my sexual orientation and my personality, I could become influential in government and then be able to do some things. In fact, as time went on, Stonewall came. We began to make real progress in this. I was a part of the movement. We were making progress, and I was able to become influential in government. The problem is, by that time, government was no longer influential in society. That is, now I had governmental power, but the government couldn't accomplish what I wanted. So I realized this is what had happened, and my goal in part in the book is to talk about how we can reinvigorate government. But as I've done these conversations, one thing occurred to me that's important. People have asked, did I say they were correlated? No, they weren't. But that in and of itself is a very important point. 10 years ago, there was a view that the reason white working class men were not voting for Democrats anymore the way they'd voted for Harry Truman and Franklin Roosevelt, et cetera, people of that demographic, was their alienation because of the social issues. It was God, guns, and gays. It was abortion. They were turned off by the cultural liberalism. Well, that clearly turns out to be untrue. The fact is that support across the country for treating LGBT people fairly has gone up as support for government in general has gone down. if one was the cause of the other, that couldn't happen. I mean, I was, apparently NASCAR is complaining about the law in Indiana discriminating against gay people. That is proof that it wasn't, we weren't the ones who drove people away from the Democratic Party. I talk about what I think happened. But it came naturally to me because I started out in life trying to figure out how to overcome any gay prejudice. And then somewhere along the 80s, the balance shifted, and I had to figure out how to reinstitute some respect for government.
So I think, you know, with an eye toward that, I was struck by what you wrote in the book about the advantages of taking a political movement to the streets versus working through the process to achieve it, and where the balance between that is. And I think a lot of people might be surprised by the conversation that you had with then Governor Gavin Newsom in early 2004.
Excuse me.
You're all going to give me a pass on that, right? Then Mayor Gavin Newsom in early 2004, as he was contemplating whether to instruct the city to grant marriage licenses to same-sex couples. What did you tell him and why?
Well, I have been a firm believer that my friends on the left make a mistake by not more thoroughly taking advantage of the political process. Let me begin. I said God, guns, and gays wasn't our problem. Well, but guns is part of the problem. Pound for pound, the NRA is the most influential organization in America beyond their general percentage. And it has nothing to do with demonstrations. You have never seen a shoot-in by the NRA. They don't march around with their guns. Few wackos in Texas do, and the NRA wishes they wouldn't. They vote. They get all their people registered. And when a bill comes up, they call everybody, the city council, the assemblyman, the senator, the supervisor, the representative, and they have a lot of impact. And unfortunately, too many on the left find expressive politics more satisfying. Best example, contrast Occupy and the Tea Party. I didn't agree with everything Occupy did. I thought some of their economics was a little unsophisticated, but I agreed with the thrust of their position. And I very much disagreed with the Tea Party, although there were some with whom I've been able to work in trying to cut back excessive American military intervention. But in general, I was very disappointed because the Tea Party has been so much more effective than Occupy, not because they represent more people, but because they're smarter about how to do it. I mean, just in summary, when the left gets mad, they tend to march. When the right gets mad, they tend to vote. And voting beats marching. And with regard to Mayor Newsom, here's what happened. One of the great leaders in American history, in my judgment, your Congresswoman Nancy Pelosi, who is a great force for good, called me in 2004 and said, Mayor Newsom would like to talk to me. Now, remember, Massachusetts had a decision in 2003 from our state Supreme Court allowing there to be same-sex marriage. Unlike California, that could not easily be put to a referendum. There was a process by which you could go through a referendum, but it had to get a certain number of votes in the legislature. Mitt Romney, then our governor, immediately decided that his route to the Republican presidential nomination in 2008 would be as the one who destroyed same-sex marriage in Massachusetts. And we engaged in a major fight over the legislative elections of 2004. We won, and we protected same-sex marriage. But at the same time, George W. Bush, inspired by Karl Rove, figured, aha, this would be a great issue for me in 2004. So he announced that we had to have a federal constitutional amendment to protect everybody in America from same-sex marriage. Now, the fact is, none of them were under the threat of it, except in Massachusetts, because at that point, same-sex marriage was state by state. And it seemed very clear to me, almost a military analogy, Massachusetts now was a beachhead for same-sex marriage. And I was confident that we were going to be able to show, by having same-sex marriage, that all of the arguments against it were nonsense. The notion that somehow our marriages were going to destabilize heterosexual marriages. I remember saying on the floor of the House, when they called that thing the Defense of Marriage Act, okay, let me understand, apparently, you've seen the V8 commercials, apparently gay men, we were the V8 of marriage, because there would be happily married men all over the state of Massachusetts, and they would find out that it was possible to have a same-sex marriage, and they would look at their wives of long standing with whom they were in love and say, I could have married a guy. And and that would weaken their marriage. Well, we knew that would be disproven, but here was the deal. I did not want to fight that fight nationally because we would have lost it. I lobby members of Congress all the time. I would go to members of Congress and say, you know this amendment that George Bush has? And there was a Republican majority, but we only needed 1/3 plus 1. I would say to Democrats from Ohio, Pennsylvania, even from the South, and certainly from New Mexico, Colorado, please vote against this amendment. It doesn't mean you're for same-sex marriage. You can say that you don't want it in your own state, but you want Massachusetts to be able to make its own decision. And I was confident that if we protected our beachhead in Massachusetts, it would spread, and that turned out to be the case. And then Nancy Pelosi asked me to call Gavin Newsom, who tells me that he's planning to conduct same-sex marriages in San Francisco. Now, if he had the legal right to conduct same-sex marriages, I would have said, great. But he did not conduct same-sex marriages. He conducted symbolic mock marriages. It was very clear that there was no power in the mayor to do that. The California Supreme Court, which later found a California constitutional right for marriage, ruled before that that a mayor can't just go ahead and say he wants to marry people. And so after Newsom did it, a couple of others did it. And what I explained to him was my fear was this. If it now is the case where any elected official in a city can announce he's going to perform marriages because Massachusetts did it, the argument would get nationalized. And I would go to people from other states and say, please don't take away our marriages in Massachusetts. And they would say, hey, pal, I've got nothing against you, but I got my people afraid it's going to happen here. And that was my disagreement with Mayor Newsom. I was afraid that if this looked like it was going to spread, we would lose our ability to fight it one state at a time. What happened, of course, was the California Supreme Court threw that out in a hurry, and that put an end to the argument. But the price we paid, and there's a very good book by a man named Richard Corman about same-sex marriage, a Harvard professor, and he has a great quote in there from Karl Rove welcoming Gavin Newsom's move. Because, again, in Massachusetts, we can argue, look, that was a careful process. It went through the state Supreme Court. It's not going to blossom everywhere, although ultimately we hope it would. But after the experience, what he said was, we're going to scare people that Gavin Newsomism is going to spread all over the country. And as a result, they put referenda on the ballots in many states, which not only said no same-sex marriage, but helped bring out anti-John Kerry voters.
What are your thoughts on these so-called religious freedom bills that we now see popping up in various states, most recently in Indiana and in Arkansas?
Counterintuitively, they are the best thing that have happened since the Supreme Court decided the Defense of Marriage Act. I'm about to write a column I write for the Portland paper, and I'm going to say, to quote one of your former governors in a little bit of strange form, there I go again. because I filed the first gay rights bill in the history of Massachusetts in 1972. I was closeted, by the way, but I decided when I could run for the legislature that I would be a coward but not a hypocrite, that I could not acknowledge who I was without not getting elected. But I was determined from day one that I was going to be an advocate for gay rights. And nothing to me is more despicable than gay and lesbian people in office. But it's mostly gay people, because the lesbians don't do this. They don't become Republicans. It's gay men. It's gay men who hold public office and then support anti-gay policies. To be a gay man who makes life miserable for other gay people, that's not privacy, that's hypocrisy, and it should be opposed. But in the 40... what, plus years since 1972, I have consistently underestimated the progress, and I'm happy to have been wrong. But I finally said, you know, after those recent court decisions for marriage, I finally accept the fact that we're making very good progress. And then along comes these decisions, and Mike Pence, a conservative governor in the culturally conservative state of Indiana, buys into something that had been an anti-gay tactic for a while, and the roof falls in on him. Not only are the kind of hip new businesses condemning him, Cummins Diesel. What could be more mainstream America than Cummins Diesel or NASCAR? And they are going after him. And I now say, you know what? There I go again. I underestimated it. I am delighted. I think what we are now seeing is the death throes of any significant homophobia, because you have the business community saying to him, and Walmart saying to the governor of Arkansas, who I learned today has just held off, Ace Hutchinson, I served with both these guys. They're both conservative guys. Asa Hutchinson was one of the leading guys trying to impeach Bill Clinton, who's now the governor of Arkansas. And what they are both saying is, well, Hutchinson's holding it off. In Mike Pence's case, it's delicious. Look, I will tell you, the worst situation for a politician to be in is when you feel you have to say something that is patently untrue and that no one will believe, but you have nothing else to say. So Mike Pence has to announce that a piece of legislation that was drafted entirely to allow people to discriminate against gay people does not allow discrimination against gay people. As my husband said, apparently he thinks he's the only one in the whole world who understood what that bill meant. Everybody else knew the opposite. And the fact that there was this reaction is people are not going to try this again. And here's the big point. And I was talking with someone who said, well, you know, the guy that had a sales force said, I'm doing this for economic reasons. And from the personal standpoint, you might wish, well, no, why don't you make it a moral statement? But I was very happy to have it be done for economic reasons. There's a quote I have in the book, Warning of the Dangers of Elitism, from Adlai Stevenson when he gave a wonderful speech, as he was always doing. And a woman said to him afterwards, Governor, your speech was wonderful. You have the votes of all the thinking people. He said, yes, madam, but unfortunately, I need a majority. Well, not a good way to get people's votes. So here's the deal. I'm very happy that, once again, those who believe morally in the importance of not discriminating spoke out. But I'm even happier to have the people who are in it for money, because that's when you win in American society. When it becomes a threat to the efficient functioning of the economy, and that's what they're being told. Stop with your hate. Stop with this nonsense. We want to all make money together and create wealth. And that, so that has been a very nice turnaround.
Since we're talking about the power of the dollar in such things in the business community, let's shift for a second. We've had an interesting lineup of guests over the last couple of days at the Commonwealth Club. There was Senator Bernie Sanders, who is an independent Democratic socialist senator from Vermont, was here on Monday. Yesterday in Lafayette, we had one of the foremost libertarian thinkers in the country, David Bowes from the Cato Institute. And I find that you wrote something in the book that sort of puts you sort of dead between them in an interesting sort of way. And this is early on in the book, but you came to this realization early on in your political life that the best system was one where the creation of wealth relied primarily on market mechanisms, with a strong government providing appropriate regulation, lessening inequality without destroying incentives, and playing an active role when necessary to keep the economy functioning at high levels of employment. So, you know, you've got the libertarian free market, you've got the albeit not quite socialist,
well,
government regulation and control.
How
did that sort of shape the tack you took in Congress, especially when it came to the run-up to the duration of and the recovery from this recession?
That's a good question. I it's very well formulated, and I appreciate it. Let me just say, first of all, I think with David Boas at Cato, I have worked closely with the libertarians on half of their agenda. That is, you know, staying out of people's personal lives. I was a co-sponsor with Ron Paul, Rand Paul's father, of legislation A, to stop excessive military intervention, B, to legalize marijuana. In fact, Ron and I were working together until he got a little too serious that he could be president, which he couldn't be. And he was a man of great integrity, and I, for much of my career, I was able to have a very good time because I, being gay, being Jewish, talking funny the way I do, I know my diction's not too great. I get in a cab, and I tell them where to go, and half the time, because cab drivers spend a lot of time listening to the radio, oh, I know who you are, because I could never make anonymous phone calls. I'm aware of that. So, anyway, Ron was in that position, too. You know, I didn't think I would lose my seat. I couldn't go anywhere else. I was having a good time doing what I wanted to do. And in 2012, I approached Ron about signing another letter to tell the federal government to stop interfering with people's marijuana laws. And he said, oh, Barney, I can't do that. Why? He said, well, my campaign staff says, you're killing me in Iowa. That the association with me was hurting him in the Iowa caucuses. But a lot of the libertarian approach, I liked. And by the way, I said I worked some of the Tea Party. Here's the ground for agreement. And some of the Tea Party people understand this. Their skepticism that the federal government can accomplish anything within our own country logically ought to make them even more skeptical of efforts to rebuild a coherent society in Iraq or Afghanistan. If we can't do it here, how are we going to do it in a foreign country? And some of them understand that and will make that argument. But in my own case, here's how it affected me. I do believe that the free market system works best to create the wealth, but you need rules. If you don't have rules, what you get is a race to the bottom. The best example of that, the CEO of Citicorp, Chuck Prince, they had this deal where you could have the bank owe money, but they had something which was an off-balance sheet device which they could use. An off-balance sheet meant something very simple. You owe the money, but you're allowed to pretend that you don't. And that was, and that's how you get in trouble when you got to pay it off. And I said to him, Chuck, why is that off your balance sheet? Why isn't that on your balance sheet? He said, because if I put it on my balance sheet, I'll be at a disadvantage if Goldman Sachs doesn't put it on theirs. So that's why you need rules, so that the businessmen don't get driven to that. You also need to take some of that wealth, and this is the key point, you take some of the wealth and you use it to take care of the people who aren't going to do as well. Inequality is necessary for capitalist society. Too much inequality is socially and economically damaging, because if you have too much inequality, consumption is depressed, and consumption is the single biggest part of the economy. At any rate, that's what I thought. So here's what we did with financial reform. I saw the problem as being, not just me, but the people we work with, that the financial community had come up with a way to separate taking a risk from the responsibility for the risk. Many of you will be familiar with it. Many people here took out a mortgage 40 or 50 years ago, and you borrowed money from the bank, and the bank checked you out, and you then had to pay the bank back every month. And because you were paying the bank back every month, the bank frisked you pretty good before it lent you the money. And then by the 80s, thanks to money coming in from outside the banking system, from the OPEC countries, from Japan with its big surpluses from the balance of trade, loans were being made outside of banks. And even more important, thanks to information technology, even a bank could make 1,000 loans, and instead of waiting for 1,000 people to pay them back and checking on that, you package them into a security and you sell it. So that at that point, if you're the lender, it's no longer important to you that the people pay back, because you've gotten your money up front. So you go from caring about the quality of each loan to making a profit from the quantity of loans. Similarly, you get into the derivative business, and in derivatives, derivatives are a multiplier. So you promise to do things, you make a huge profit, but you don't have the money to back it up. Quick example, AIG, American International Group, they were so profitable as an insurance company that they started selling something called credit default swaps, which are a form of insurance, but because it wasn't called insurance, it was exempt from the rules. If I buy a security based on these mortgages, I can then buy from you a credit default swap, which will pay me if my security doesn't pay off. So when mortgage loans that shouldn't have been made default, I then go to the person who sold me the credit default swap and said, okay, you got to back me up. AIG was doing very well with those, because a very small amount of money would make a big profit, because they never thought there would be a need for it. In 2008, they come in and tell the Bush administration, we are $85 billion short of being to make our payments that we owe. A week later, when the Bush administration is going over how much they're going to need for this, they say, oh, an $85 billion for AIG. We said, no, you already told us that. They said, oh, yeah, that's just the second $85 billion. AIG not only did not have the money to pay their debts, they were $170 billion short and didn't know how much. At any rate, what we did was this. We reconnected taking risks with the responsibility for the risks. We don't tell any company, AIG or any other, you can't sell credit default swaps. What we say is, you got to sell them on an open market and exchange, you got to be public about it, and you have to have the capital back it up. When you buy health insurance, certainly when you buy property insurance, casualty insurance, life insurance, the company has to have money to pay off the claims. We made that same decision here. We generally don't tell the businesses what risks to take. The law says, take any risk you want, but you better have the money to pay off. And if you don't, by the way, you're going to be wiped out. Sarah Palin was half right in 2009, which for her was very good, high average. She said we had death panels in the health care bill. No, we didn't have death panels in the health care bill. We allowed people to make their own decisions. We did have death panels and do in the financial reform bill. Today, if an AIG came in and said to the Federal Reserve, I can't pay my debts, and the Federal Reserve could not allow them simply to not do that because it would cause this downward spiral, Federal Reserve would say, okay, fine, you are out of business. You're abolished. Your shareholders are gone. We take all your money. We will then pay some of your debts to prevent a further crisis, although we will recover them from other financial institutions. So today, any institution that can't pay its own debts, the first thing that happens is they're put to death.
We discussed this a little bit last night with Mr. Bowes, who made his libertarian ideal case that, first of all, that this crash, this recession, was due to overregulation, not underregulation, and secondly, that the ideal solution is not to have government imposing these regulations, but rather to just let those businesses fail completely and let whatever consequences happen without any government role in them if they take these unsound risks.
Yeah, well, they tried that with Lehman Brothers. Here's what happens. First of all, you don't have any regulation, so companies can run up as much debt as they want and as other people will lend them. And then at some point, Company A cannot pay hundreds of billions of dollars it owes other people, so it doesn't pay them. Those people, in turn, can't make their payroll. The people whose payroll isn't met can't buy any goods. Other people don't have money. So there is a reverberating effect from this. And it's true, they say, fine, that's the price of freedom. The price of freedom will hurt people very badly who don't have a lot of money. And I was told, well, why did you have to try the banks? Well, people should be very clear. If we had that kind of economic collapse, the heads of J.P. Morgan Chase and Goldman Sachs would not have been homeless. They had a lot of money salted away. It was the average guy living from paycheck to paycheck who would suddenly not have any place to cash the paycheck or maybe somebody to pay it. Secondly, as to overregulation, I don't know what he meant by that. There is this one conservative myth. If you get my book, please read the appendices. There was this myth that says, oh, you liberals force people to lend money to poor people. Exactly the opposite is the case. Liberals tried on several occasions to stop the loans to low-income people that they couldn't repay because it was bad for them. We tried in 1994. We passed a bill that told the Federal Reserve to do it. Alan Greenspan said, no, I'm not going to do that. In fact, he said, you'll find this quote in my book, it's true that some of these loans carry a high risk that they won't be repaid, but you cannot have a capitalist system without political support for property rights. Lending this money to these poor people makes them into supporters of property rights. So it's kind of a political bribe to make them conservative, except when they couldn't pay the money back. So that is this great myth. In fact, in 2007, well, let me go this way. It also had to do with Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. And I was at the Huffington Post, and I picked up a copy of Dick Cheney's memoirs, and I gave it what we call a Washington read. That's where you go to the index and look for your name. I will tell you this, by the way. Almost no book on American politics is written that does not mention Benjamin Franklin. And the reason I know that is that as I go down the index, and if I come to Franklin, that means Frank is not in there, because Franklin comes right after Frank. But I find that Dick Cheney says the following. In 2003, we tried to reform Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, one of the entities that was involved, although by no means the single biggest cause. But Barney Frank, chairman of the Financial Services Committee, killed the bill. Well, in fact, I was not chairman of the Financial Services Committee in 2003. A Republican was. The Republicans controlled the Congress from 1995 through 2006. When all the bad stuff was happening, they were in control. I did become chairman in 2007, 4 years later. And the first year I did, I passed that bill. You can read that in the book by Secretary Hank Paulson. So I was pretty upset that Cheney falsely says that I was chairman of the committee in 2003 and killed the bill when it was the Republicans who did it. But then I realized this is kind of an interesting position. Dick Cheney has lied about what I was doing in 2003. You know what that makes me? The equivalent of Iraqi weapons of mass destruction. Because he lied about them in 2003 too.
Well played. while we're on the subject of the recession and the recovery, a key player in the TARP, the Troubled Assets Relief Program, just ran for governor here in California last year on the Republican
ticket.
Neil Kashkari.
I always thought Kashkari was a great name for him, like made up to serve the purpose.
What were your impressions of him as a steward of TARP?
Oh, I thought he was able and efficient carrying it out. And I thought the TARP was necessary, but I had one major problem with it, which I admired Hank Paulson. I think he was very responsible. But we had this one major difference. I wanted some of the money from the TARP to be used to alleviate the foreclosures on people's homes. Now, we ran into a political problem there because people who were paying their mortgages were objecting to other people getting these payments. The argument, however, was that someone forfeiting his home maybe was reasonable for his or her irresponsibility. But when accumulated to the way it did, it hurt the whole economy. And not just the whole economy, it hurt whole neighborhoods. If you have a house on a block where four of the homes are foreclosed, your property values have gone down. You're living with these abandoned buildings. So we tried very hard to deal with that. And we said to Paulson, please, we're going to give you this money, but you have to use some of it for foreclosure relief. He didn't do that. And he said, oh, yeah, but I have this urgency. I have to get the money out to keep the finance system afloat. And Kashkari was aware of that. So he wasn't doing anything about foreclosure relief, but it wasn't his fault. It was a man I generally admire who made that call. Finally, Paulson says to me in December, okay, you're right. I used $350 billion of this. I have the right to ask for another $350 billion subject to congressional disapproval. I will ask for the second $350 and I will use it for mortgage relief, but this is now after the election. One of the most interesting things that people haven't focused on is this crisis begins a month before the presidential election, and it plays out during the interregnum, which is a terrible period. Some of you may have read about the problems that happened between Herbert Hoover and Franklin Roosevelt. And in fact, we amended the Constitution, or people who were then alive did. It used to be that you took over as the new president on March the 4th, and they moved that to January 20th because of the terrible problems that happened for 4 months when Hoover and Roosevelt were fighting. But even January turned out to be too long. In this sense, Paulson finally said to me, okay, I will ask for the second $350 billion and use some of it for foreclosure relief if the president-elect says it's okay. I'm not going to do this in the interim between elections. I tried to get the Obama people to do it. Obama, I understood why he refused. He said, look, I don't want to have responsibility for them spending $350 billion that I can't control, so I'm not going to ask them to do that. I was very frustrated, and I understood, and the president's people said, Obama's people said, you got to understand, we only have one president at a time. The problem was we have this period where no decisions are getting made. I get frustrated. I did say, well, when he said we only had one president at a time, he was overstating the number of presidents we had during that period. And they all got angry. But
that got you in touch with both presidents.
With both
right?
presidents. But the problem, and that's so, it wasn't done well. Now, Elizabeth Warren was being very critical of that, and I was, but here's my dilemma. People said, well, you shouldn't have given him the money if he wasn't going to do that. Yeah, and Samson should have broken down the temple. I mean, here's the limitations of being in the legislature. Particularly in a crisis situation, the executive has the initiative. In the legislative body, you can modify it. We did get him to put in executive compensation restrictions and made sure they paid us back with a profit. But you can't redesign the whole program. You pretty much have to go yes or no. And no would have been a terrible disaster for working people. So that's why we had to go along and then fight to try and make it a little better. But we were frustrated that we never did do enough in foreclosure relief.
We have a few questions from the audience on the subject of campaign finance reform. We have someone asking, can we not have a government of the people again by eliminating all personal or supreme, or via the Supreme Court, contributions by either drastically shortening electioneering or making radio and TV free for a certain amount of electioneering? Another question, simply, how can we get money out of the dominant role in our electoral process?
That's a central issue we have. First, we can't shorten the election period without changing the First Amendment. I mean, the other thing is, the reason we have longer election periods is that we we have these fixed terms. People know when they're coming. But anyway, our First Amendment means you can't stop it. But we can curtail money, and we could. For the entire, from 1787 until into this century, it was considered that you got a right to restrict money. And then we got a right-wing Supreme Court majority that announced that to have a democracy, you had to have unlimited use of campaign money by anybody. If that is the case, by the way, we should feel pretty good, because that makes us, in the last 15 years, the only democracy in the history of the world. Because no other functioning democracy, not France, not England, not Israel, not Norway, et cetera, has ever played by those rules. And I like when they said they have the people back. And there's a philosophical argument here. We have two systems, as I said. We have a capitalist system, which I think does a good job of generating wealth if it's properly regulated. And in that system, the principle is inequality. The more money you have, the more influence you have, the more you can decide what to produce. If you guess better what the public wants, then you do that. We have a political system that's supposed to be independent of that, where the principle is one person, one vote, where you are not supposed to have inequality. What the Supreme Court has done is tear down the separation between those two so that the inequality principle of capitalism floods the equality principle of the political situation. And there is one thing we can do about it. This is a, as often the case, a partisan response. We can elect a Democratic president so that she can appoint a Supreme Court justice. Well, that's the practical fact. She can appoint Supreme Court justice to turn this around. Ordinarily, we have the view, as lawyers know, once a court has made a decision, you let it stand. Stare decisis, Latin for let the decision stand. And that makes sense, because you cannot have a society where one group does something and the other group uproots it. That's part of the Tea Party's problem. They don't understand that elections have to make decisions and you can move on. They want to uproot everything. If that was the case, every time you had an election, you'd have total chaos. But in the case of a decision that was narrowly decided 5-4, and that was very much contested, and that has not led to deep institutional roots, you can overturn it. And I believe that if we get a Democratic president and one of the five retires, maybe Kennedy, maybe, I don't pray much, but certainly that it should be Scalia, you could get that decision overturned, and then we could get rules back to where we were.
This is the Commonwealth Club of California program, and we are talking to Barney Frank, author of Frank, A Life in Politics from the Great Society to Same-Sex Marriage. I'm Josh Richmond, political journalist for the Bay Area News Group, and your moderator. You can hear Commonwealth Club programs on the radio, catch up with us on Facebook and Twitter, and see program videos on our YouTube channel. So let's talk about this presidential election to which you alluded. You spent part of a chapter in the book talking about your defense of the Clintons in the 90s as they came under attack from various quarters. What do you think Secretary Clinton has ahead of her if, as many of us presume, she runs for president?
Well, I'm glad you prefaced it with the defense. One of the things that troubles me is people say, well, see, Hillary Clinton is going to be another issue. I want to be very clear. Kenneth Starr, who in the 19th century would have been the star of Les Mis. I mean, he was this obsessive prosecutor determined to get her. She and the president together were his Jean Valjean. He came up with absolutely nothing negative about Hillary Clinton, and it bothered me. I started serving on the banking committee in 93 when they were going after Whitewater, and they investigated that, came up with nothing. Actually, what happened in Whitewater, the Clintons outsmarted themselves, lost a little money. Politicians should not become land developers. You stick to what you know. And then comes impeachment. And in September, before the congressional elections, Kenneth Starr sends up 11 impeachment counts against Bill Clinton, and he does not tell us. He's still investigating Whitewater, the FBI files, the travel office. He doesn't have anything to say about that, but he has 11 counts of impeachment. The impeachment counts turn out to be 11 ways of saying oral sex. That's the only issue. He then sends a report after the congressional elections when they hope to get the majority to impeach him, and he reports that with regard to Whitewater, with regard to the FBI files, and with regard to the travel office, there was nothing to implicate either Clinton in any wrongdoing. And I am pleased that I got to ask him the question. Before the election, you sent us this recommendation of impeachment. on the one count that you'd been studying for about a year. On the other three counts, which you had been studying for 2, 3, and 4 years, you were silent until after the election when you exonerated him. I said, let me ask you, when did you exonerate President Clinton on the question of the travel office? He said, I can't give you a date. I said, well, you know, what do you mean? He said, well, we never exonerated him because there was never anything to incriminate him. At any rate, so let's be clear, they never had anything negative there. I believe, I also do not think emails is a big deal. I don't think anybody cares which email server anybody used. If something negative came up, that would be an issue. By the way, as to Benghazi, I heard the concession a month ago. I was on Meet the Press, so I was watching Trey Gowdy, the South Carolina Tea Party guy, who's the chairman of the investigating committee. He's the one who said that he agreed with Eric Holder that we should lessen criminal sentences in many cases for drug users, but because Holder was for same-sex marriage, he didn't think Republicans could cooperate with him. So this is the level of judgment you're getting from him. The moderator said to him, there have been 4 investigations already of Benghazi, and they've all come up with nothing. You're going to be the 5th. What's the point of this? He said, well, even if all we can do is corroborate the other 4, that will be useful. So they're not looking, again, on TV. So what then happens? I believe, and I know there are some of my friends on the left who, oh, this isn't good. We can't just have an easy nomination. Well, I got to be honest with you. If you look at Hillary Clinton's record, from the standpoint of a liberal Democrat, she's a pretty good buy. Paul Krugman, who's the best commentator on economic affairs we have, during the 2008 election documented that she was to the left of Barack Obama on some domestic issues. She was too hawkish. He was a little too hawkish. I do think that that's one of the things I want to work on. On the domestic set of issues, she's fine. And I do not understand this notion of we must have a primary. In the first place, if you have a primary these days with the media and it's over ideology, it gets angry. So the Democrats who want to see Hillary Clinton or any other Democrat elected really think that what we need to do is to repeat what the Republicans did in 2012 and have a messy fight. And secondly, I'm going to be honest, I'll offend a few people, and that happens. I think there is, on the part of some on the left, an uneasiness if we appear to be in the majority at any given time on a set of issues. We see ourselves as the spark. We see ourselves as the insurgents. It's our job to inspire and challenge the rest of the country. So being in the majority can sometimes seem too comfortable. And people got to look for trouble where it doesn't exist. And then you go back to that first question. Given the money that's going to be floating, I don't want to waste any money in primaries. I think Elizabeth Warren is right when she says she should keep doing what she's doing as a great defender of things and not run for president and get diverted in the press starts just gaming her for that. So now on the other side, there's no slam dunk, obviously. Winning a 3rd straight presidential election for one party, is the odds of statistically that does not happen. You lose that more often than not. But the Republicans are very badly split. I think they're going to have trouble coming up with a nominee who bridges that gap. And so I'm somewhat optimistic right now.
On the topic of the Republican field, former Florida Governor Jeb Bush is here in the Bay Area today and tomorrow raising funds through his super PAC. He has not yet declared his candidacy. What are your thoughts on the people who seem to we've got maybe 13 names floating around in the GOP field, but who do you think are the few who are likely to rise to the top?
Well, it's very hard a year this far in advance. Nobody saw John Kerry when he got it. Nobody, you go back, Jimmy Carter, George McGovern. I suppose it was pretty predictable that it would be John McCain. But Scott Walker, to me, is troubling because he is a less strident extreme right winger. Look, and I hope that this will become clear, and white working class men in particular will understand, this is a man whose appeal to his party is based entirely on union bashing. That good for him. And this troubles me. I've had this debate with Lawrence Kudlow on CNBC. If we talk about people at the top making too much money, we engage in class warfare. But if they worry about janitors making too much money, they're being economically responsible. That's what Scott Walker does. He goes after maintenance workers who are public employees and says their pensions are too generous. And Then he moves into right-to-work laws to go after private unions. Liberals may have underestimated this. This is a very important example here about unions. Robert Corker is a kind of mainstream Republican senator from Tennessee. He's not a Tea Party guy. Volkswagen opens a plant in Chattanooga and says to the UAW, we'll recognize you as a union because we've had good relations with unions in Germany. So UAW petitions for an election, which you have to do under American law, and it's clear that they're going to win this election with the support of the company. And Senator Corker and other Tennessee Republicans then make Volkswagen and its employees an offer they cannot refuse. They were about to provide some public funds to help expand the company. So much for free market conservatism. And they announce that if the union wins the majority of the voters, they will not provide those funds to expand the company because they hate unions so much. And someone said to Corker, wait a minute, the company is for it. Why are you getting so upset? What he said is very revealing about inequality, about the parties, about unions. He said, you know, if Volkswagen recognizes the union, they'll be able to push wages up. Interesting, because conservatives used to tell workers, unions can't help you. But they acknowledge that they do. And he said, if Volkswagen's wages go up, that'll have an upward pressure on wages elsewhere in Tennessee. And if wages go up in Tennessee, we will lose our ability to get industry to move from other states down here. So he's worried that he won't be able to get industry away from California or New York or other places with higher wages. I'm hoping, that, as I said, we can focus that on Walker. Bush worries me less. I think there was a great vulnerability in him. One other issue I want to throw up against Bush, talked about death panels. In 2005, I was sitting at home in Massachusetts somebody just mentioned it, the Terri Schiavo case. Terri Schiavo was a woman who was, we now know from the autopsy, a lifeless mass of flesh. Her brain had dissolved. She was being fed. And that was the only sign of anything you would call life. She was totally comatose and no possibility of life. There was nothing. Her brain stem had dissolved. It was jelly. Her husband, after years of this, in accordance with what he said were her wishes, said, we're going to stop artificially feeding her. Her parents objected. So they went to court. Every court in the state of Florida said, no, the husband's got the right, and she said she wanted this. Stay out of this. So Jeb Bush persuades his brother to convene a special session of Congress so that Congress passes a law overturning the courts of Florida, the most outrageous violation of the separation of powers you can imagine, that orders him not to remove the tube. And they wanted to do it in such a hurry that they had to pass it on a Sunday, because he might have done this on a Monday. A little bit of an aside. I thought it was too flippant to say at the time, but it's after the fact. The report was President Bush had been in Texas, and he flew to Washington to sign the bill instantly so that they could stop him from doing this. And the report was that we didn't get the bill passed until after midnight because we were fighting it. So the report was that President Bush had signed the bill in his pajamas. And I wanted to use an old Groucho Marx quote from the Animal Crackers, when he was Captain Spaulding, the African explorer. Some of you may remember that. Hooray for Captain Spaulding, the African explorer. Did someone call me Schnorrer? Hooray, hooray, hooray. But he had this great line. He said, last night, I shot an elephant in my pajamas. What he was doing in my pajamas, I'll never know. So I want to say, I don't know why there was a bill in President Bush's pajamas. But Jeb Bush was the driving force. And at the time, and this was encouraging to me, members of Congress voted for that bill, most of whom didn't like it because they thought the public would demand it. I knew because I was the floor leader of the opposition. The next day, because I'd been on television for 3 hours opposing that bill, I had people stopping me on the street to thank me. And the public was outraged at it. A couple of months later, Jeb Bush is such a fanatic on the subject that he asked the district attorney, the county attorney there called in Florida, in the county where she had fallen and incurred the injury, to investigate her husband to bring criminal charges against him. Now, this is about something like 11 years. Lawyers here will understand what that means. What criminal charge could have been brought against him 11 years later? Murder. Everything else, the statute of limitations. So that degree of fanaticism, I think, will not serve him well, that he wants to have the government tell you that the government will decide when you can pull the plug or not.
A question from the audience. Somebody would like to know how much longer you think it's going to be before we see a GOP presidential nominee who's pro same-sex marriage.
Probably 12 years or so. There's a generational thing. The problem is, as the country moves, the people who vote in Republican primaries have become a very hardline conservative group. And I think it's going to probably take another 12 years for them to... They've evolved to the point where they don't want to bring it up, but their political base, they're entrapped by their political base. I think it's going to be another 12 years at least.
Another question from the audience.
Well, let me just point this way. Actually, sure. You know what the Republicans are hoping for now, most of them, the sensible ones? That the Supreme Court takes the issue off the table. What the Republicans are hoping for is a Supreme Court decision that says same-sex marriage is a national constitutional right, and then when you ask them, they're going to say, hey, the Supreme Court said it's a right, let's move on. They will accept the reality of the Supreme Court, and they hope that'll neutralize the issue.
We have a question, also election-related, from the audience, asking if you think that voting, at least in presidential elections, should be mandatory, what the pros and cons of that would be. And this is in the context of a state where we just had pretty much the worst turnout we've ever seen in the gubernatorial
election. Actually, if you're going to make it mandatory, it would be more important to do it in the non-presidential elections. But I'm still not for it. Maybe after a while people get used to it, it's one thing. But at this point, we suffer from nihilistic, angry voters, people who are voting because they have to. I don't have a lot of confidence that they would be making reasonable decisions. They just vote because they were pissed off and against somebody who they thought was behind it.
An audience member asks, recently the Democrats have lost the alliance of white working men. Can anything be done to counteract this trend?
That's one of the central themes of the book. It's why I wanted to write the book in part. The question is why. As I said earlier, there was this view that it was because the Democrats got left on cultural issues. I think that's clearly not the case, because we've moved, not just gays, marijuana. And white working class men, in case anybody didn't know it, smoke a lot of marijuana. In fact, one of the reasons, in my view, why we should stop prosecuting that is that it is in the criminalization of recreational drug use that racism has its greatest impact, in fact, in America today. It is very discriminatorily enforced. Here's the deal. I think that the white working class men are against us, not because they are philosophically opposed to government, but for the opposite. These are people who believe that government has a potential role. They know about Franklin Roosevelt and Harry Truman and John Kennedy and Lyndon Johnson. But here's the problem. Beginning in the 70s, worldwide economic trends have worked to their disadvantage. In the immediate post-war period, if you were an American, you didn't have to have a high degree of skill or technical degree. You went to work at a factory and you made a lot of money. Or you were a construction worker, you made a lot of money, a decent amount, have a good life for your family. And then the economy shifted to their disadvantage, so that increasingly the wealth being created went to high-end people, et cetera. Our trade policies exacerbated that. And they are now angry because they think that if government and the people who run the government really cared, they would not be so badly off. And when they talk about the people who run government, they mean us. The Democrats are the party of government. Very frustrating to me. Democrats have had the House, the Senate, and the presidency for exactly 4 years since 1980. The first two of Clinton and the first two of Obama. But we're still held accountable. It was very plausible for Cheney to blame me for something that happened when the Republicans were in power. Talk about bailouts. I don't know if I mentioned this. People, all those Democrats in the bailouts. There were five bailouts in 2008 and 2009, every single one initiated by George Bush, but people still blame the Democrats. So white working class men think that the liberals in charge of government have refused to help them economically. Now, this is where the social issues come in. It's not that they are anti-women or anti-gay. It is, though, that they do think that the reason that we have abandoned them is that we're paying attention to these side issues. I think if we were able... This is my positive answer. It's in the book. If we were able to expand those programs that alleviate the economic distress of white working class people, that diminish inequality both now and in the future, that would have a positive effect, not just because these are good things in themselves, because they would once again see government as a source of good things, as people did with after World War II, et cetera, as they did with Medicare. The problem is, vicious cycle, we don't have the money. As long as people are angry, they won't vote to let us have the money, certainly not to raise taxes. So I think what we need to do is to save substantial amounts of money that are now being spent and free them up to be used for programs that will, for example, let's say that any student who's capable can get a first-rate education for $1,000 a year or less, the way it used to be at first-rate public universities. Let's reduce Medicare to 55, taking a lot of the pressure off people. Let's do a massive program of infrastructure so that every construction worker and all kinds of people who could join the construction industry, including women, because through technology that could be much more gender integrated, let's put all those people to work building the roads and fixing the bridges and doing all the things that we need for ourselves, wastewater treatment plants, et cetera, et cetera. Let's expand the cleanup of hazardous waste sites, which includes some people who are doing physical work. If we could do that, I believe we would both diminish their economic insecurity and have them see government as a good source of things. So the question is, where do you get the money? And there are two ways. You cut back on this massive over-expenditure on the military, and in particular, you curtail these interventions. If we had not gone to Iraq, we'd have $1 trillion. We could have used half a trillion to cut the deficit and $500 billion to have done a whole lot of good things. We tell our great friends in Western Europe that they needed us in 1946, but now, economically, they are capable of doing what they need to do to defend themselves. Here's the trick. We had massive military expenditures because we were threatened with existential damage. We were threatened with destruction, first by the Nazis and then the communists. By 1990, when the Soviet Union collapsed, we were not in danger of our society being destroyed. It ended before that, but take that as a thing. George H.W. Bush and Bill Clinton began to reduce the military. And there were a lot of people who didn't want that to happen because they want America to be the leader of the world. They want America to be the one that enforces order all over the world, not because we're threatened, but because in their view, that's what a great country does. And they were very frustrated until 9/11. And they seized on 9/11 to build up these murderous terrorists, terrible murderous people, but they built them up as if they were the equivalent as a threat to us of the communists or the Nazis. And they built the military budget back up in irrelevant ways. I wish that nuclear submarines with armed nuclear missiles could defeat terrorists, because they don't have any, and we have a lot, so it would be over. Much of what we are spending is irrelevant to the current threat. And that's one thing. Secondly, you stop treating people as criminals because they use recreational drugs we don't like, unless it's a drug that caused you to harm other people. Heroin does not cause you to harm other people. Needing the money to buy heroin causes you to harm other people. If we were to legalize this, I want to discourage people through, like we discourage smoking. I want to offer treatment to anybody, but locking people up is a great mistake. And people say, well, do it less expensively. Why does it have to cost so much to send some people to prison? Why does it cost more to send someone to prison than to the state university? A very simple answer. People don't try to escape from the state university. That's why it costs them. So if we were to free up a lot of money from those two things, we could then do the things that would make this a fairer society and reverse this alienation of white working class people who are legitimately angry that they have been mistreated. They are just misidentifying who's behind it.
How do you think the pop culture of politics has affected people's view of government over the course of your career, from the West Wing to House of Cards?
Negatively, and I'm glad you mentioned it. West Wing was excellent. It was a thoughtful portrayal of people grappling with their problems.
You'd vote for Josiah Bartlett.
I would vote to keep it on the air. House of Cards is an unremitting disaster. It is inaccurate. It is distorting. I will tell you this for sure, but this is truth. A good friend of mine just returned as the American ambassador to a country that is badly governed by a man who is corrupt and anti-democratic. And on instructions from the State Department, he said, Mr. President, you know, we really are troubled by your failure to do this and that. And the answer was, oh, please, I know what goes on in your country. I watch House of Cards. So that kind of distortion is terrible. My good friend and colleague, Shelley Pingree, the congresswoman from Southern Maine, said, look, we're not that evil and we're not that clever. Things don't always work that way. Beyond that, though, I have had my differences with, say, Jon Stewart and Stephen Colbert, and I differentiate that from Bill Maher, whose show I was just on. If you watch the Comedy Central stuff, no government official has ever done anything that wasn't stupid and ridiculous. Now, they are generally accurate in what they say, but if that's all you say, you get a distorted picture. Bill Maher succeeds in being very funny by differentiating, by talking about things that happen that are good and things that aren't. So I think what pop culture does is, look, we have two kinds of voter suppression in this country. We have the vicious, outrageous voter suppression that Republicans enact that physically keep people from voting. You require people to have all this identification. When one of those bills passed, one of my colleagues in the Black Caucus said, my mother doesn't have a birth certificate because when she was born in Mississippi in 1922, they didn't give black people birth certificates. So how is she supposed to show up with one to vote? On the other hand, we have intellectual suppression from the left. If you tell young people in particular that they're all fools, that they don't care what you think, that only big money counts, that they don't pay any attention to you, why would you vote? So I think the pop culture has been a depressant in terms of getting people to vote.
On the topic of voting rights and civil rights, you got your start in the civil rights movement to some extent. And here we are in 2015, you know, coming off this the Ferguson protests of last year and similar situations across the country. Where are we and where are we headed on this?
Well, I'm very happy that the population of Ferguson, the African-American population of Ferguson, is now post-demonstration, and they're registering to vote, and they're having elections soon, trying to elect African-Americans to city council. That's what you need to do, is to take advantage of the voting. And for that reason, look, I had a very mixed emotion week in 2013, when the Supreme Court first threw out DOMA, which was wonderful, but then outrageously threw out, in effect, most of the Voting Rights Act. You know, we just saw the 50th anniversary of Selma, people getting badly beaten to get that Voting Rights Act passed. And by the way, demonstrations worked there, not in a direct way, but given the unwillingness of the South to let people vote, it was necessary for African Americans and their supporters to physically confront that so the rest of the country understood it and then could vote for it to overturn it. That Supreme Court decision that gutted the Voting Rights Act was a terrible one. It's one that I hope, again, if we get the right president, will be overturned.
Well, we've reached a point in our program where there's time for only one last question, so I'll try to jam two very similar audience questions into one. Will you run again, please, was one of the questions. The other one is, have you ever thought about leaving New England for the moderate climate in San Francisco? We'll be looking for a mayor soon.
Well, no, I'm too old to run again. I was just emotionally worn out. And secondly, I found love late in life, and this is related to not running again. And I enjoy it enormously now. My husband was here until he flew out this morning and he had to go back to go to work because he puts up awnings for a living. Jim's a surfer, and yes, he could surf here, but you don't offer him the same snowboarding opportunity that he gets in Maine. So that's the deal killer.
Well, we used to offer those snowboarding opportunities until we had no snow.
When you had snow and water. Yeah.
So
He also likes to shower, and who knows how long you'll be doing that.
Sadly true. What does the immediate future hold for you?
Well, when this book tour is over, I do commentary on MSNBC and CNBC, which I enjoy. I give speeches for money. I may try to write another book. If I do, it's going to be to make my case that we need to free up the resources to do the things that I've talked about, and in particular to reduce America's worldwide military situation. I think that the time has come to scale back America's self-imposed duty to be the leader of the world and let somebody else have a turn.
Do you see any voices in Congress who are going to carry that banner going forward?
Well, yes, some, by the way, on the Tea Party side. A guy named Mick Mulvaney, and others, Barbara Lee, to talk about a near neighbor right here. Leader Pelosi herself has been very sympathetic to the need to be realistic, and there are others as well who are ready to make that argument.
Very good. Our thanks to Barney Frank, author of Frank, A Life in Politics, From the Great Society to Same-Sex Marriage. We also want to thank our audiences here on radio, television, and the Internet. I'm Josh Richman, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned.
I'm sorry.
Oh. I'm so sorry.